In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
If you want to know how and why the wildfires have gotten so bad in California, you need to look to Oregon. Oregon, at one time, was proud of its timber industry. It was part of Oregon's identity. But thanks to the environmentalists, people were made to feel ashamed of it. That is some pretty good Marxist reprogramming right there, a bit like what you would see happen in a cult. Oregon is a prime example of why far-left environmentalists should not be in charge of anything, least of all the environment. From 1952 until 1987, Oregon experienced only one catastrophic wildfire, defined as more than 10,000 acres. Just one, in 35 years' time. But after the environmentalists moved in the early 1990s, thanks to Bill Clinton and Al Gore, Oregon has seen more and more catastrophic wildfires every year, especially so in the last few years, than it has ever seen. You would think that after a few years of hundreds of thousands of acres burning up, maybe Oregon might do a little more preparation to prevent such things. But last year was the largest, most expensive wildfire season in Oregon's history, with some 2 million acres burned up. And no, it is not climate change. But unless things change, Oregon environmentalists are about to destroy the very thing they claim they want to protect. Today, we have a mega show for you, Make Economics Great Again. When it comes to government, which has too large of a role in economics for my taste, when it comes to the government and money, they burn piles of it. That's because politicians and bureaucrats have no skin in the game. There are no consequences for bad decisions, and therefore, politicians and bureaucrats will reward whatever programs keep them in office, no matter how much harm their policies actually do. My wish list for the Trump administration is hold people accountable. And that's not just lawfare and the abuse of the justice system, it's the abuse of the American taxpayer that needs to stop. There's a lot of hope going into the Trump administration. I am personally looking forward to a truly better economy, and not what we've had these last 4 years, which is a bad economy marketed to look good. And I'm also especially looking forward to finally getting serious about cutting government spending and everyday people finally seeing their costs go down and their income up as Trump settles in and gets down to business to make America great again. To make economics great again, I'd like to welcome Jonathan Williams back to the show. Jonathan is the Executive Vice President of Policy and the Chief Economist at the American Legislative Exchange Council. You can visit them at alec.org, and we'll link that up on today's show page, which is 1502 on iSpyRadio.com. Jonathan, thanks for joining us. Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year, my friend. I love that. Make economics great again. That's good.
There we go. Mega. Hey, you know, speaking of the new year, we are roughly 10 days out from the end of the Biden era. What's the mood like there at ALEC?
Well, I'll tell you what. I think, you know, as I was just out in the States early in the first few days of the year here, there's a lot of optimism in terms of what we can expect to see of a turnaround nationally, right? As there's hope again. I think it's morning in America again with so many different ways when it comes to getting back our economy, getting this inflation situation handled, looking at the real waste, fraud, and abuse in government spending with DOGE. And then, of course, what's happening at the state level, regardless. I mean, a lot of attention, rightly, and sometimes get it overblown, gets penned at Washington, D.C. here. But when you look at the state level, so many great ALEC men and women looking to lead different legislative chambers. I was in Lansing, Michigan this week, where my longtime friend and ALEC board member Matt Hall became Speaker of the House. The one legislative chamber that flipped from Democrat to Republican control this fall was the Michigan House. Mm-hmm. And now there's check and balance there again. I think there's just so much optimism that we're going to get back to policy and away from, hopefully, petty politics and away from this just horrible national disaster that we've seen over the last 4 years with lawfare and just so many bad policies coming out of Washington.
Well, and certainly not least of that is all of the bad economic policies and the mysterious ghost jobs that we've talked about a lot of times where they make the headlines and then suddenly they disappear after a few months. But I'd actually like to start today talking to you about these wildfires. This is near and dear to us because, first of all, we love the environment. We've got friends down there in the Los Angeles area, some of which have lost literally everything. And usually after hurricanes, you hear idiots on the news saying, well, think of all the economic activity this now means with all of the rebuilding. And it gets, you know, it boils back to Basquiat's broken window fallacy. I haven't heard that yet, but I have heard an awful lot of dumb people say even dumber things like, oh, look, it's climate change. Well, you know, of course, if you believe in climate change and that global warming is making the earth hotter and drier, then you should be doing more forest management, not less. And that's what the far left is doing, which is nothing, but they're getting paid anyway. But it just seems to me that the proper response to a disaster as a result of stupid policies in another state is to look at your own state policies and say, let's make sure that doesn't happen here. Do you think that California and even more importantly, other blue states like Oregon will finally be forced to face reality when it comes to environmental issues that their far left policy of doing nothing doesn't do anything except cost an awful lot of money, and in this case, cost some people everything?
Well, it's such a horrible situation as we see it unfold, just with the footage that's just tragic of what's going on in Los Angeles right now. And, you know, and first, certainly all of those families and individuals are in our prayers and hope for the very best as firefighters fight this situation. Secondly, and kind of the longer term, let's analyze, you know, what just happened here and how did it happen? To your point, Mark, is, you know, what were the policy errors at play that perhaps helped bring this about, unfortunately, and made it much worse than it otherwise would have been? And one of those critical pieces of it is, what are we doing on forest management, mm-hmm. right? And this is something that the federal government has failed at for decades. And,
yes.
and just this week, it's unrelated to what's going on. This has been in the works for a couple of months now. My colleague at the ALEC website, Joe Trotter, here put up a piece honoring a couple of members of Congress for actually advancing really important legislation that passed out of the United States House this last Congress on a bipartisan basis with 268 votes for what would be the Fix Our Forest Act. And unfortunately, the United States Senate, then under Chuck Schumer out of New York, did not pass it. So they have to come back this Congress and actually work on that again. But it's looking at these things like such as decades of just not having active forest management and having better practices there. And when you get somebody like my friend Bruce Westerman out of Arkansas, who is the lead Republican sponsor, and then you actually have a California Democrat, Scott Peters, as the Democrat sponsor, coming together to say we need bipartisan solutions to this that bring together federal, state, even tribal agencies and actually get to the heart of some of these issues, things like curbing the frivolous litigation that has delayed critical fire prevention efforts for far too long. And then, of course, that's a failure at the federal level. Then you have the California-specific failures on it and other blue states, like you mentioned, that have just not taken it seriously. And that's something that hopefully, if there is a something that comes out of this effort that can be something that is long-term, that we can make some changes. It's what can we do to make sure this doesn't happen in our town going forward?
Yeah, well, there is definitely no tragedy that bad state policy can't make even worse. And I'd like to talk to you about that in the next segment. Everyone stay with us. We'll continue with Jonathan Williams of ALEC. That's American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC.org. Stay with us. So we just found out during the break that Jonathan Williams has gotten himself a promotion. He is no longer the Executive Vice President of Policy and Chief Economist at ALEC. He is now the President and Chief Economist at ALEC. So congratulations to you, Jonathan.
Well, thank you, my friend. It is a great organization. Just so excited to continue to be a member of the team here, working with our CEO, Lisa Nelson, and just an incredible group of Americans devoted to trying to make America freer. And after nearly about 17 and a half, 18 years here, I was so excited to move into the new role at the start of the year.
Well, that's really cool, and it's very well deserved. We've certainly followed your career for a number of years now, and I just think that's awesome for you. And so I had mentioned going out of that last segment that there's no tragedy that bad state policy can't make even worse. And one of the things that I'm hearing from people that are down in these fire areas that have been devastated there in Los Angeles is the insurance issues. And one person had mentioned the FAIR plan that California is dealing with. And I don't know how much you know about this, but I'd like to get your thoughts on it. And it was established in 1968. And what it is, it's an insurance program of last resort for homeowners who are unable to obtain fire coverage in the private insurance market. And of course, in the last couple of years, you've had a tremendous number of insurers just decide to pull up stakes there in California because of these wildfires and some other issues that California's bad state policies have managed to make worse. And I'd like to read you this from their webpage. They say, when an insurance company gets licensed to sell policies in the state of California, it also agrees to financially support the FAIR plan if it runs out of money, if the plan runs out of money following a catastrophic disaster. So if a wildfire destroys a swath of homes on the FAIR plan and there's not enough money in the state's reserves in the FAIR plan to pay out those claims, the FAIR plan would then turn to the state's private insurers to help with the cash call. So this is like socialism for insurance, is where you get the benefit of paying into a system and covering somebody else's bills.
Yeah, I tell you what, like California's just got so many of those pieces of its state policy that's been anti-taxpayer and anti-business forever. And you wonder why in a lot of these cases, some of these companies have just pulled out or stopped insuring and or writing new policies in the state. I mean, I'm sure that the parallels are somewhat similar to what we see in Florida, where the cost of insurance is astronomical or you can't get coverage. And they have their kind of the reinsurance type of idea there as well, with hurricanes versus wildfires. Florida and Texas versus California, though, probably lots of important differences between those programs. The other thing, though, keep in mind is just what are the other regulations, the cost of litigation in California, and just so many other those things that do not exist in other states. So important as we look at why is it that some of these companies have just pulled out of doing business in the state.
Yeah, well, it's pretty astonishing. When because I haven't seen any damage estimates yet, and I'm sure it's going to be astronomical. And California being California, I'm sure there's a lot of those people that are on that FAIR plan. And I also seen something about a cap, a $3 million cap, and some of those houses that have burned down, I can't imagine that it's going to be less than $3 million to rebuild some of those homes. So goodness knows what's going to happen there. It's again, just a mess waiting to happen. And again, it is because of bad policy. And so one of the things that I think going forward here, as far as environmental issues are concerned, their big push right now is green energy. And I am really hoping with the Trump administration that they're going to start pulling that apart and stop funding that from the federal level and instead open the doors to things like nuclear. Is that what you expect to see in the Trump administration going forward?
Well, I think, you know, you have a Secretary of the Interior that's coming off as two-term governor of North Dakota and Governor Burgum, who has a very strong record in energy. And I think he's going to bring a whole lot more common sense to what's going on in terms of our national energy mix. And, you know, whether it's all the above in a free market context and start to get away from the subsidy approach of green energy that we've seen and just get to a free market all the above approach. I think we're going to see a lot more, as you pointed out, nuclear, a whole lot more. I think in natural gas as well. It's a huge area of exploration. The United States is incredibly rich in natural gas resources, and it's also relative to so many of the other fuels burned, a much cleaner fuel as well. And so I think, you know, what we're seeing at the state level is a pushback against this. As I mentioned, I was just in Michigan this week. It was in the news, made, you know, rounds in D.C. and Fox News and everywhere about this massive new Department of Natural Resources purchase of forest in northern Michigan to turn into a massive new solar farm.
Yeah,
that was actually canceled because of so much backlash at the idea of just being like, why are we really clear cutting? I think it was 400 acres or more in this example to build solar in a part of the country that doesn't get a whole lot of sunshine this time of the year. A good friend of mine, Representative Ken Borton, it's his backyard. It's his district. I visited with him this week, and he was on some of the national news coverage saying, you know, we've got to stop this insanity and actually get back to things that will provide us affordable, reliable energy for Americans, to get to the heart of the inflation problem, to get to the heart of during the winter season here, when so many of us are using our thermostats a little bit more than usual. We must have affordable, reliable energy as a nation. And I think under President Trump, under Secretary Burgum, you're going to see exactly that.
Well, I certainly hope so. I'm very encouraged that Trump has said recently on X and on his own Truth Social. He's been calling the climate change a scam. So I really hope that he is able to get people around him that also see it that way. It's kind of funny that you mentioned that about the Michigan forest. I mean, the environmentalists used to care about things like in the environment, like whales and forests. And here they are clear-cutting forests and plopping down windmills offshore that are damaging whales. So kind of a weird conflux there.
Well, you've seen it in Oregon for years. I mean, where are the Greenpeace activists that were chaining themselves to trees, right, when they were trying to stop the logging out in Oregon? I mean, where are they now when they want to clear-cut 400 acres of really great right. forest land up in northern Michigan? You have to ask yourself the question.
Yeah. Well, it's pretty insane because they are much more willing to do nothing, not do any forest management, and just let the fires burn, and somehow that's protecting the environment. I don't get it. All right, everyone, stay with us. We'll continue with Jonathan Williams talking about making the economy great again. And welcome back. We're talking about making the economy great again. We're doing that with Jonathan Williams. He is the president of ALEC. That's A-L-E-C. You can visit them at alec.org, and that's the American Legislative Exchange Council, and he's also their chief economist. And Jonathan, even before the show got going here, we were talking, and one of the things that came up is that recently your kids experienced staying home for just a little bit of snow out there in Washington, and it's like the teachers' unions don't want people to work. And that has been something that I've certainly been seeing more and more of, is that it just looks like when these environmentalist issues, they want to get paid, but they don't want to do the hard work of managing forests. And one of the big scams right now, I think, are carbon credits. And in Oregon, they have now taken about 60% of their state forests offline under a habitat conservation plan, which means that you can't go out there and harvest timber, except on maybe a very limited scale. But one of the things they're looking at doing is to sell carbon credits. And one of the three ways that you can make some money off of carbon credits is you have an established forest and promise not to log it, and you can sell carbon credits on an acre basis or however they want to do it. This is also part of Oregon and other states' net zero plans. Have you heard anything about what Trump's administration wants to do with the net zero and all of the carbon credits and everything else that goes along with that?
Well, you know, it's a good question. I have to figure the inclination is to give it a very thorough scrubbing and review as either part of the DOGE effort or just independently of that in the agencies, because this is just way over the top what we've seen over the Biden administration in the last several years. And so it absolutely needs to be addressed. I mean, you combine this with just this recent announcement of President Biden trying to take off all those millions of opportunities of potential oil and gas
yes.
exploration off the outer continental shelf, and not to mention just how much of land on back on shore for a minute, how much land for decades the federal government now owns and has just held and has restricted development totally in some cases of especially the states west of the Rockies. For somebody who grew up on the east of the Mississippi, this is not really that big of a deal. But when you look at some of those numbers, like I was just studying up again today, you have a state like Nevada that is now over 80% mm-hmm. of all the land mass in the state of Nevada is controlled by the federal government. And you have over 60% in places like Idaho and in Utah in the West. I mean, Oregon's not that high of a percentage, but I mean, we're talking about substantial pieces of state opportunities for private sector development. We're not talking about national parks here or state parks. We're talking about land that could be developed, could be used for oil and gas exploration in some cases, or could be used for lots of other private sector pieces. And that's just, I mean, I think this philosophy here in the Biden administration that needs to be upended.
Well, I would certainly hope so. And as I said in that last segment there, Trump does seem to be aware of how much of a scam this climate change nonsense is. So I'm hoping that's going to be derailed. And you had mentioned the oil leases there, and I'd want to talk to you about this. But since you brought it up, he's trying to take those offline. I have heard that it may not be quite so easy for Trump to claim those back. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it's, you know, I'm talking to a lawyer about that this week who works on some of those policy issues. It's not quite as easy based on, I think it's a 1950s era law that it would, it was not as easy as just having an executive order to reverse it like you would see in other cases. You actually may need Congress to be involved in actually having something proactive done on a legislative basis. Given the very tenuous majority that exists numerically in the House, especially. There's no margin for error there, obviously. And so that is something that remains to be seen. Obviously, you have a 60-vote threshold in the Senate on many issues, the threat of a filibuster. But I understand it, as talking to folks in that piece, is not as easy as just coming up with an executive order and reversing it, unfortunately. So that may be there for quite some time. The precedent is horrible in the final days of the administration, though, to try to tie the hands of your successor as a new president to try to stop them and gum up the works before they're even inaugurated is a very poor form at the very least. Not surprising, I suppose.
No, I suppose that's not. It's amazing how much damage Biden is trying to do on the way out the door. He's been handing out billions of unspent EPA grants. He's been shoveling more money at Ukraine. And it's just, I mean, it literally feels like he's trying to burn things down on his way out the door. And especially with what's happening there in Los Angeles, where a lot of those the Biden type of policies and the far left have really led to that. As far as moving forward here with the Trump administration, one of the big things that he wants to do is get the federal deficit under control. And that means he's either going to have to raise revenues, you know, where people are paying more taxes, that kind of thing, or he's going to have to pretty severely cut spending. I honestly don't see how you get that deficit under control without the latter, where you've got a lot of spending that's being cut. As things stand right now, exactly how much needs to be cut to get us down to where we're not in deficit spending?
Well, I mean, we're talking not in the millions, not in the billions, but we're talking the trillions,
right,
at this point. So we're talking a lot of all of a sudden a billion here, a billion there. It adds up to real money as the line goes. And so it is it's a really huge task ahead. And there's no doubt about it. There's no sugarcoating it. There's going to be some really tough decisions ahead, whether it's the DOGE effort or whether it's through the regular congressional process and whether it's through OMB and the White House hopefully being the bully pulpit on this in many cases and talking about the need to meet spending to a way that's sustainable, again, spending levels. The other options, of course, in addition to spending reduction, which is absolutely a necessity, Mark, you're correct on that point, is, you know, back to my point on how much does the federal government own and why does it own it? And can it sell off some of this massive amount of assets,
right,
that the federal government owns? And by the way, put that money back to productive use in the markets, the private sector, and back on the tax rolls for states and local governments that are not having any of this being able to be used for that purpose. That's a huge area of opportunity. And I hope that OMB looks at that, the Office of Management and Budget, with Russ Vogt being nominated to serve in that role again.
Well,
the other thing, of course, we need to look at is real sustained economic growth and what will it take to, you know, to bring 3 or 4% GDP growth back on a concentrated level, back to the levels that we saw pre-Biden administration after the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, for instance, brought trillions of dollars overseas back to work in the United States. So I think it's a multi-layer equation here, but at the end of the day, you still can't get there unless you see real spending discipline.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, let's go ahead and take a break there. Lots more to talk about with Jonathan Williams. He is the president of ALEC and their chief economist. Coming back, we're going to continue our discussion about making the economy great again. And welcome back. This is the i5 Radio Show. We're talking today to Jonathan Williams. He is the president of ALEC and their chief economist. ALEC is the American Legislative Exchange Council. You can find out more about them by heading to ALEC, ALEC.org. And we'll link that up on today's show page, which is 1502 on iSpyRadio.com. And Jonathan, we've been talking about the necessity to do some spending cuts here at the federal level. And just to tie back into something that you had mentioned earlier, is you guys have a DOGE coalition there. How does that work? Are you guys advising them? Are they bringing in ALEC staff? What does that look like?
Well, it's really fun to be able to work with our friends there in the administration on this. Back in December at our winter ALEC conference in Washington, we hosted a couple of different sessions that kicked this off. We had Vivek Ramaswamy come join us, who's co-chairing Doge with Elon Musk, of course. He gave a keynote address at our meeting and just relayed to us how important the ALEC effort would be. And, you know, the way he said it is exactly right, is if they're successful at Doge, it's going to mean that our ALEC members are going to have a whole lot more work to do, because we're going to take ideas and functions out of D.C. and use this idea of decentralized power and federalism under the 10th Amendment of the Constitution and actually have state and local governments pick up many of those things that the Fed shouldn't have been doing in the very first place. Now, the other piece that we had at our meeting was we invited U.S. Senator Joni Ernst on a panel discussion with a couple of other friends I moderated, and she's the Senate chair of the Doge caucus there in the U.S. Senate. We're going to be featuring Congressman Pete Sessions from Texas as the House chair at one of our upcoming coalition meetings. But there at our meeting, we launched the ALEC Government Efficiency Coalition to really bring the heart of the idea of federalism and taking the ideas, not just D.C.-centric ideas from Congress, is we need to make sure we take the very best and brightest ideas from the state level and bring them to our friends at Doge and say, hey, we're going to be able to make a big difference if we can just learn from the successful examples of the states that, by the way, in many cases, like Texas, have had Doge efforts going on every single decade. They go through all their government programs and agencies and say if it isn't affirmatively reauthorized, it goes away. And so they've actually ended complete agencies or programs within agencies by doing that periodic review. So there's some really good things here. We don't have to reinvent the wheel. There's some really great ideas that have worked at the state level. And let's let those things at least have a shot in their day in the sun here in Washington.
Well, did he give you any targets as far as what they're looking at cutting in terms of spending?
Well, I think it's right now it's really all the above. They're just analyzing from top to bottom. And that was very early in the process, even before it's officially launched here with the new administration, obviously. But I know that they're going to be relying heavily on ideas from the states and ways to get money back out through block grants or other things to the state level. I do think that they're going to look very much at the things like the Department of Education. It was, as President mentioned during the campaign, it's something that President Ronald Reagan had on his wish list to eliminate altogether, and not a single child has been directly educated by the Department of Education over its 40-plus year history. And so looking at for some of the low-hanging fruit like that, there's, you know, billions of dollars that have gone unauthorized by Congress that continue to be funded. And that's kind of a big question to answer, is if it's so that important of a priority, why don't you get Congress to authorize its spending? So those are a couple of things, I think, off the top that we could absolutely need to look at. But I think there needs to be a thorough top-to-bottom review, just like any private sector entity would do. If you can't answer the question of what does success look like and what are the metrics of success look like, should this be done in the first place?
Well, exactly right. And, you know, I've mentioned the climate scam a couple of times, and that Trump does seem to be pretty interested in defunding a lot of that. But aside from the environmental issues, and there was about $2.2 trillion between the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act and the Inflation Reduction Act, much of that is going to so-called green energy. It's not green because it generates a tremendous amount of toxic waste, and nobody's utility bills are going down as a result of those either. But how does some of that federal spending at the federal level, when those start being cut for federal programs, how much of that filters down to the states where they are losing funding for something that they're doing? Because I know that they get block grants and some of these other things to do whatever environmental nonsense they want to do. A lot of that comes through the EPA. So how does that going to impact some of these states?
Well, some of that remains to be seen as to how how big of cuts we'd be looking at the federal level. But I'll tell you this, Mark, in that the state legislators I talked to at ALEC, they're more than up for this challenge to say, yeah, I know that's a lot of times it gets spun by the liberal media as a negative for the states, and somehow this is going to be bad for individual taxpayers across the country if states have to do more of this work. I actually think that that's going to be a huge net positive, that states are going to take up the functions that they need to take up, and some of these functions are going to be, probably redundant in the first place. They're going to go away. And so I think looking for redundancies is going to be a huge area. Now, there's no reason why multiple agencies have similar functions necessarily to provide similar products and services, right? So just taking an overall top to bottom review, I think, is going to be so important. I know that members of Congress have done yeoman's work already plowing the fields on this for many, many years, that they're going to take ideas as well. I was introducing Senator Ernst there at our meeting. I mean, she released a report that week talking about just the kind of savings we could see by having the federal workforce go back into the office, right? And we're having all this unused office space, and if folks aren't going to use it, maybe the federal government shouldn't hold all the buildings here in Washington, D.C., or maybe some of the federal workforce and contractors ought to be located outside of one of the most expensive markets in the world to do business and to live and work, right? I mean, so some common sense things just on FTEs and on the federal workforce, in addition to really top-down review of some of the full agencies and programs.
Well, and it gets down to people not working again. Have you ever heard of mouse wigglers?
No, I don't know if I'm familiar with the concept.
Yeah, that may not be the exact term for it. Maybe it's just mouse movers, but there's a device that you can get so that when you're working remotely, it will randomly move your mouse every so often. So it looks like you're on your computer. And apparently,
that takes it to a whole new level.
Yeah, well, this was, I think, on a Tucker Carlson show where I saw that. And they were talking about cutting these federal employees that are remote and they're not actually working. So that will be an interesting thing going forward. Let's go ahead and take a break there. Everyone stay with us. We'll continue our discussion about making the economy great again. We're doing that with Jonathan Williams. He's the president and chief economist at the American Legislative Exchange Council. We're talking today to Jonathan Williams. He's the president of ALEC and their chief economist over at the American Legislative Exchange Council. Their website is alec.org. And so, Jonathan, we were talking during the break there about the strings that are attached to the federal government, the federal government funding for states. Before we get there, though, you had brought up an interesting situation for the federal land sales where they may want to divest themselves of some of these assets. And it's kind of weird because it's sort of the mirror image of what Oregon has done, where they have taken 60% of their state lands, which had been an asset, and they've now turned that into a liability because they'll be out there putting out fires, which of course are going to happen when you don't maintain the forest. And instead of bringing in revenue, they're now going to be spending money on those state lands. And the federal government is looking at doing the opposite, where currently they are spending money to support those lands and keep them maintained, allegedly. But now if they can sell it, they'll take a liability and turn that into an asset. So that's really cool that they're looking at doing that. Have you seen any figures on that in terms of how much they think they might be able to bring in if they start divest or how much they're currently spending and how much they might save?
Well, it's a very interesting point in that there's a couple of pieces to this. One is, I asked that very question back a number of years ago during Trump administration 1.0, back when Mick Mulvaney was the head of the OMB, the Office of Management and Budget in the White House, and they convened a group of us to kind of think through some budget savings ideas. And I asked that question, and the answer that I got from the White House, and this is not a knock on any White House, it's just the knock on the fact that we don't know some of the answers to these questions, is the federal government broadly does not know how much it owns or how much to value it at. Isn't that a scary thought? And wow. A lot of state governments are the same way, is they don't have a good inventory of their assets, and they don't necessarily have a uniform way of valuing property or making sure they get an accurate valuation of that to know how much it's worth on a balance sheet scenario. And so that's a really big issue that I hope that the OMB takes on once again, and it was able to make continued progress on that from the first Trump administration. The other piece of this is, what are state and local governments losing out on when that property, let's say in the case of these states where 60 or 80% of total land is owned by the federal government, what does that cost the state and local governments to determine of foregone property tax revenue or other economic activity that is not happening by design? And actually, the state of Utah has a petition right now in front of the U.S. Supreme Court to ask them to take up this, because under provisions of previous law or even constitutional provisions they're pointing back towards, the federal government clearly was not meant to hold on to this land indefinitely. And Utah and other Western states think it's time to revisit that. And I think they're exactly right to be pursuing it.
Well, even if they don't know the numbers, the encouraging thing about that is that land is sitting there basically doing nothing now. And if they start selling off that land, think of all the jobs that will then create. It's not just getting a cash payment, you know, one-time deal where somebody buys so many acres from the federal government, but they're creating things like, you know, farms, or they're going to harvest timber and replant that. And so they have an ongoing source of income like Oregon is supposed to be doing, or building houses. I mean, that's really, that could really generate the jobs, but also all the taxes that then go to the federal government anyway.
Yeah, that's right. And the state governments.
Exactly.
And by the way, for the property taxes and assessments that have been going up all over the place, what this would do by expanding the property tax base and putting more of that the property back on the tax roll,
right,
it would lower the other property taxes as a result. If the governments are actually on the ball and saying we're going to have this as a huge opportunity to reduce property taxes across our localities.
Well, I think that's all encouraging news. I really hope that they can move forward with that. So aside from cutting the spending, there's another question that I had meant to ask. Is that, so in terms of the spending that the federal government currently does, how much can they lock down that spending when they hand that cash off to the state? Can they have some pretty stringent strings, or even better, some chains attached to that spending to say, you must not do this, you have to do this, so that they can't just go off and hand them some money and then, hey, guess what? We're going to go off and spend that on some new environmental scheme.
Yeah, I mean, this is done in Washington all the time as money goes out of Washington to the states. And, you know, generally, I like the approach a little bit more of just getting the federal government out of the function altogether,
right,
and saying if the state wants to pick it up on their own, let them do that. God bless them if they want to. But if they don't, maybe it's good for the private sector or for charities to pick up. I think that's probably the preferred approach. I don't necessarily, as a good federalist myself and believing in state autonomy, I don't really love the federal government coming in with that approach, because it comes back to bite us as people who want to see states succeed and be able to have these 50 laboratories of democracy.
Mm-hmm.
But it is something that has happened under Republican and Democrat Congresses and administrations that they want to put these controls. And you can imagine why. There's a good rationale to say there should be control because it's federal taxpayer money and they want to see it done and implemented the way that Congress envisioned it to be implemented, right? So there is an argument to that side. I just think, like, over time, if we want states to be strong and autonomous and we believe in this idea of federalism, we should just have the federal government not just pass the money to the states, but actually pass the functions of government to the states.
Yes, yeah, and I would agree with you on that one. So aside from cutting the spending, the other side of that coin is increasing revenue. And so there was a report recently that showed that according to the S&P Global Market Intelligence, there were 694 U.S. companies that filed for bankruptcy in 2024. It was the highest single year tally since 2010, which was itself in the aftermath of the financial crisis of 2008-2009. But what was also shocking about that was that the S&P report said that there was a quarterly record of $8.5 trillion in total debt among credited non-financial U.S. companies. I mean, that's stunning. $8.5 trillion, that's like a third of the economy's GDP is basically borrowed money. So how do we start getting these jobs coming back, actual jobs, not those phantom jobs? How do we start getting companies to start being able to turn things around, which will then start generating some income for the federal government?
Well, I think it's back to the basics. It's back to what we saw work so well in Trump administration 1.0 in 2017, the Trump tax cuts. The Tax Cuts and Jobs Act were really rocket fuel to the economy. We saw trillions of dollars coming from overseas back to work in the United States to put Americans back to work here. We saw insourcing of manufacturing from places like Mexico to places like Michigan, right? I mean, things that we would have thought unthinkable just a decade earlier happened because of the incentive changes of making America more competitive again. As you know, and we've talked about many times on this show, is if nothing is done in Congress by the end of 2025, by the end of this year, that those individual provisions of the Trump tax cuts go away, that would be catastrophic. I mean,
yes,
that would be almost a guaranteed recession, I believe, for our economy going forward. And so, you know, not only just renewing the Trump tax cuts, but actually extending them, maybe going to more of a flat tax, getting the rate down more for businesses and individuals. I mean, the small business aspect of the Trump tax cut was one really the unheralded, didn't get nearly enough attention in the mainstream media for sure, of what that meant for mom and pops and startups and entrepreneurs across the country that took advantage of so many of those new tax provisions. Mm-hmm. And the other thing to keep the economy strong and to get revenues going naturally by not raising tax rates. I mean, Jack Kemp, one of our heroes at ALEC, always said you raise more revenue by increasing the amount of taxpayers, increasing your tax base versus raising rates. When you raise rates, obviously you run into the issue of foregone growth. You lose revenue because of the Laffer curve effect on competitiveness, and more businesses go overseas or stop doing business, right? I mean, you see this issue time and time again at the state level, as we've documented in rich states, poor states. So a Trump focus on deregulation, the whole two for one, I think, if not more. I mean, two regulations repealed for every new regulation. I think we're going to see more of that approach, as well as renewal of the Trump tax cuts. I think that puts us on an amazing path for a great economic future in America.
Yep, absolutely. It's back to that old notion of more taxpayers, not more taxes or higher taxes. All right, everyone stay with us. We'll wrap things up with Jonathan Williams talking about making the economy great again.
Hello, this is Joe Biden. You know me as the resident of the White House, but I'm here today to make a very important announcement and introduce you to my favorite radio show heard right here on this station. Did I ever tell you I invented radio? Or maybe it was the phonograph. Well, I know I used to listen to the radio on the photograph anyway. The colors were amazing, even in black and white. Wait, is radio the one with the dots and dashes? You know, beep, 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 boo, boo.
Yeah, that was Virgil Joe there introducing this segment. And, you know, there's a small part of me that's going to miss him, but only a little. This is the iSpy Radio Show, Virgil Joe's favorite radio show. And we're in our final segment now with Jonathan Williams. He is the president of ALEC and also their chief economist. Their website is alec.org if you want to go visit them. And I highly encourage you to do that. And so, Jonathan, in the time that we have left, I'd like to continue talking to you about how, on the other side of the coin, yes, we want to cut spending, but we definitely need to raise some revenue as well. Trump has said that he wants to move away from income taxes and move towards a tariff system. You know, for over half of our country's history, I think a lot of people forget that we had no income tax. It was primarily funded by tariffs, correct?
Right. And, you know, not only that, but it was prohibited in the United States Constitution originally as having an income tax. And I think for very good reason.
Yes.
I think the founders were awfully skeptical of what it would mean when the federal government could directly tax individuals and their income, and not just because of the power to tax, is the power to destroy, as famously said by Chief Justice Marshall, among others. It was the idea of privacy, right? And why is a central government in a far-off city in Washington, D.C., going to know that much about individuals in their books to be able to know what they made in a given year, to be able to tax them on their income.
Mm.
And so I think it was really a travesty and something that has really come back to bite American taxpayers in a major way for now over 100 years.
Yes.
When the 16th Amendment to the Constitution was adopted back in the Progressive era. And it's absolutely been horrible for the country and what it's meant for the growth of government.
Are you surprised that along the way there was never an effort to repeal that?
Well, there's efforts. There's no doubt. It's just a question of it being a very high bar at this point. And the more you, it's kind of the old question of an alcoholic or an addict. I mean, once you get addicted to the revenue,
yes,
like the federal government is, and it's such a large percentage of total federal revenue now comes from the income tax, is withheld in many cases, if you're a W-2 employee, from your paycheck, where if you don't look at your W-2 statement or your withholding, it just automatically gets deducted. And then at the end of the year, people are thinking they're in good shape because they get a $100 refund back. It's like, no, look at how much the federal government just fleeced you over the course of the year. That's how the addict has gotten into a place where I think it's going to be very, very difficult to get out from under that at this point. That's why at ALEC, you know, we're so excited about what's happening at the state level, from states trying to either get down to zero or go to a flat income tax and begin to make that progress at the state level. Because before I think we're going to be ever successful at getting rid of the federal income tax, although I would be very much in favor of that, I think we need to get a state or two on the books to completely eliminate their personal income tax. New Hampshire, by the way, at the start of this year, Mark, I don't know if you saw this, became a full no-income tax state. They had always been a no-income tax state on wage income, but they eliminated investment income from the tax code. So that was a huge victory that did not catch nearly enough attention. New Hampshire, live free or die state, now a full no-income tax state.
No, actually, I did not see that. So that's really encouraging. And I think you're right. I think in some ways, we probably need some states to lead the way to show that this is, in fact, possible, that you can do this. Have you guys at ALEC, or maybe you know of somebody else that has done this, have they ever done any feasibility studies as to say, okay, yeah, if we phased out the income tax, we really could live on just tariffs?
Well, I mean, it's a question of the size of government spending at that point, right? I mean, with how large government spending is at this point, tariffs would have to be astronomical to fund this current size government. I think it gets back to the broader discussion about DOGE and the need to find really some right-sizing of government. You know, we have Rand Paul out there, you know, talking about what was the penny plan of how do you balance the budget by just taking out 1 cent of every dollar of government spending. Now, the federal government's gotten so bloated in recent years, it's now become the sixth penny plan. Just as a small example of how much government has grown in recent times, that's what it would take to get back to a balanced budget under Senator Paul's really idea there. But I mean, it's so far out of whack. I think we're really in tough shape in Washington until we address the spending side of the equation.
Well, you had mentioned that you guys are working with DOGE, and I know that you work with some other federal congressmen and senators as well. As ALEC works with the state legislators, are there some state-level policies that are so good that they ought to be implemented at the federal level that you guys have already worked on now? I mean, we talked about the income tax, getting rid of that, but are there some other policies that you think ought to be implemented at the federal level?
Well, I'm glad you asked. You know, ALEC has been up to this for 50 years. We've amassed nearly, I think it's now over 1,000 pieces of model legislation from our members over the course of our history. And one of the great pieces on this is our state budget reform toolkit that back coming out of the financial crisis, we put together for this very reason to say, if you don't have enough revenue coming in and you want to cut government spending or you just want to go at government spending for efficiency purposes and use it to cut taxes for hardworking taxpayers, here's a bunch of ideas of what have worked. So I encourage everybody to check the ALEC State Budget Reform Toolkit because this is we're not plowing new fields here. I mean, this is stuff that, you know, free market conservatives have been thinking about for a very long time. And it turns out whether it's Colorado's Taxpayer Bill of Rights or government efficiency efforts at the state level that we've studied, lots of great ideas there that I think are, many of those ideas, very applicable to what Elon and Vivek are up to with DOGE right now.
Well, we definitely have got to cut spending, not just the federal deficit and the national debt, but there are all those unfunded liabilities that are out there just waiting to devour us if we can't get this spending under control. Jonathan, unfortunately, we are up against the clock. I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Always great to join you, my friend. Exciting times here in Washington.
Oh, absolutely. Belief systems are a tricky thing, but a quick test to find out whether or not somebody truly believes in something is whether they believe in it enough that they are willing to pay for it. Take away the tax deduction for churches, would you still tithe? Most people probably would. Take away taxpayer money, would climate changers pay out of their own pockets to support their belief? Congress has been spending hundreds of billions of dollars on climate change. Perhaps only the true believers should be the ones paying for it. And if nothing else, let's make politicians and bureaucrats accountable for stupid policies based on a belief system. Because as we say every week, the best information is no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.